Hello, I'm Professor Marcus de Sotoy, and this is a podcast of Episode 2 of A Brief History of Mathematics, first broadcast on BBC Radio 4. I think of Leonard Euler as the mathematician's mathematician. No history of mathematics is complete without him. In the year Isaac Newton died, Euler, then aged just 19, was awarded the most prestigious mathematical prize of the day, the first of many, many achievements and accolades he would receive during his lifetime. The annual mathematical challenge issued by the Paris Academy of Science in 1727 was this. What is the best way to arrange masts on a ship? At first sight, it's a very practical problem. But the young Swiss mathematician Leonard Euler attacked it as a purely mathematical puzzle. Despite having never set foot on a ship, he felt perfectly well qualified to calculate the optimal arrangement of masts. For him, it was a problem that could be solved by mathematics alone.
I did not find it necessary to confirm this theory of mine by experiment because it is derived from the surest and most secure principles of mathematics, so that no doubt whatsoever can be raised on whether or not it be true and takes place in practice.
Leonard Euler had absolute faith in mathematics. He's one of the most prolific mathematicians of all time. There are just so many mathematical ideas named after him. 50 years after his death, his work was still being published. He overhauled almost every area of mathematics. And, almost as an aside, he solved a popular 18th century conundrum about the seven bridges of Königsberg.
For Euler, solving the problem was an entertainment, was something to do. And of course, he could have had no idea how we would build on his work, build on his insights, and use it to create and run a network that has changed the world completely.
The internet. For Euler, the problem was really just a piece of light relief. But the mathematics he produced when solving it has since transformed the internet. It's now used to make search engines much more efficient.
A Brief History of Mathematics with Marcus de Sotoy.
From an early age, Leonard Euler
calculated without any apparent effort, just as men breathe, as eagles sustain themselves in the air.
He proved theorems for fun, but his father, who was a clergyman, wanted him to train for the ministry.
I had to register in the Faculty of Theology, and I was to apply myself to the Greek and Hebrew languages, but not much progress was made, for I turned most of my time to mathematical studies, and by my happy fortune the Saturday visits to Johann Bernoulli continued.
Johann Bernoulli was an outstanding mathematician based in Euler's hometown of Basel, where in the 18th century the Bernoulli family had a sort of mathematical monopoly. They produced 8 outstanding mathematicians in just 4 generations. Johann tutored Euler and persuaded his father to let him study mathematics instead of religion. And it was Johann's son Daniel, a great friend of Euler's, who found him his first job at the academy in St. Petersburg, where Daniel was based. It was in the medical department, which wasn't ideal, but before he left for Russia, Euler read all he could about medicine. Such was his mindset, he managed to turn even the physiology of the ear into a mathematical problem. But when he arrived, he moved quietly from the medical section to the mathematics department, and nobody seemed to mind. And it was while he was here in St. Petersburg that Euler learnt about the well-known Königsberg Bridges problem. The Prussian city of Königsberg was split into 4 distinct regions of land by the several branches of the River Pragel. 7 bridges connect these 4 different areas, and in Euler's day, it had become a Sunday afternoon pastime among residents of the city to see whether they could find a way to cross all the bridges once and once only and get back to where they'd started. Euler wrote to the court astronomer in Vienna, telling him what he thought of the problem.
This question is so banal, but seemed to me worthy of attention in that neither geometry nor algebra nor even the art of counting was sufficient to solve it. In view of this, it occurred to me to wonder whether it belonged to the geometry of position which Leibniz had once so much longed for. And so, after some deliberation, I obtained a simple yet completely established rule, with whose help one can immediately decide for all examples of this kind whether such a round trip is possible.
Instead of endlessly walking around the town, testing out different routes, Euler created a new geometry of position, in which old-fashioned measurements like lengths and angles All measurements, in fact, were irrelevant. What matters is how things are connected. It's the same principle that's used in the map of the London Underground.
The London Underground map is not a physically accurate map. I'm at Temple Tube Station, and on the map, it's quite a distance from Embankment. Actually, it looks much closer to Blackfriars. But in reality, Blackfriars and Embankment are about the same distance away from Temple Tube Station. If anything, Embankment is probably slightly closer. But this is the beauty of the tube map. Measurements are unimportant. What matters is how the stations are connected together. And this is exactly the kind of logic that Euler applied to the problem of the bridges of Königsberg. Euler decided to think about the different regions of land in Königsberg that were separated by the river as points, or stations, and the bridges linking them as lines connecting them. And what Euler figured out is this. For a round trip, without retracing your steps to be possible, every point, or station, except the beginning and the end, must have an even number of lines coming in and out. Not surprisingly, if you apply this to the circle line, you find that a round trip without retracing your steps is quite possible, as every station has just two lines attached, one going in and the other coming out. Applied to such a simple case, it's hardly rocket science, you might think. But the clever thing about Euler's rule is that it works in any situation. When Euler analysed his London Underground-style map of Königsberg in this way, he found that every point or bit of land had an odd number of lines or bridges emerging from it. So, without having to endlessly walk around the town, he figured out mathematically that it just isn't possible to walk around the city crossing each of the bridges once and once only.
Euler's rule is easy enough to apply. The difficult bit was to frame the Königsberg bridge problem in this way in the first place, and to prove that the number of lines going in and out of any point really is all you need to know to work out whether or not such a trip is possible. And you don't need to be a mathematician to find an insight like this useful. Euler's mathematical solution to the Königsberg conundrum now drives one of the most important networks of the 21st century, the Internet, a network that links millions of computers all the way around the world and moves digital data between them with incredible speed. Technology expert Bill Thompson.
So if I've got my computer at home and I tap away a website or something like that, I need to make a connection from my computer to the computer that's hosting that website. And that could be anywhere. I don't really care where it is. All I want is for the information from that website to get back to me as quickly as possible. And I do that because embedded in my computer and all the computers that make the internet happen are rules based on Euler's work back in the 18th century when he was looking at the bridges of Königsberg and trying to figure out how you can walk around the town.
It was hardly a pressing problem at the time, more of a curiosity. But Euler's solution to this problem lives on and has revolutionised the internet. I always think of Euler as a sort of mathematical omnivore, a man who would turn anything he could into a mathematical puzzle. As scientific advisor to the Russian government, he prepared maps, advised the Russian Navy, tested designs for fire engines, and wrote textbooks for Russian schools. Although apparently he drew the line when he was asked to cast a horoscope for the young Tsar. But broadly speaking, he was free to do what he pleased. He didn't even have to teach. In the mid-18th century, many European leaders were anxious to attract mathematical talent to boost their prestige. Euler, who not so long ago had struggled to find a job, was now in demand. Frederick the Great wanted his Berlin Academy, founded by the great Leibniz, to compete with Paris and St. Petersburg. It had been a centre of excellence, but was slowly dying due to a lack of great minds. And such was the intellectual zeitgeist of the time, Frederick felt obliged to encourage mathematics, even though he himself was not very good at it. In 1740, he invited Euler to join the Berlin Academy. Euler was delighted.
I can do just what I wish in my research. The king calls me his professor. I think I am the happiest man in the world.
But the honeymoon was short-lived. King Frederick wanted fountains at Sanssouci to rival the French system at Versailles.
I wanted to have a water jet in my garden. Euler calculated the force of the wheels necessary to raise the water to a reservoir, from where it should fall back through channels, finally spurting out in Sanssouci.
For Euler, designing the fountains was a wonderful mathematical puzzle. How does water behave when it's pumped and forced through pipes? To make the puzzle a little simpler, he decided to ignore any friction between the pipes and the water. But there was friction.
My mill was carried out mathematically and could not raise a mouthful of water closer than 50 paces to the reservoir. Vanity of vanities, vanity of mathematics.
King Frederick teased Euler mercilessly. But as a fellow pure mathematician, I think it's unfair to judge Euler so harshly. Frederick wanted a fountain that he could be proud of. Euler wanted something slightly different. He wanted to understand how fountains work. And as we've since discovered, the mathematical answer to this is an absolutely fiendish equation. It's an equation that remains unsolved to this day, with $1 million currently on offer for anyone who can crack it. Age 59, Euler returned to St. Petersburg, encouraged by Catherine the Great, where he lived in style with more than a dozen household assistants and meals prepared by one of the court's very own cooks. His sight had been poor for quite a while. When he lost his sight altogether, he simply remarked,
"Now I will have less distraction."
By this time, his reputation as a phenomenal mathematician was well established. Euler had produced a dazzling array of mathematical papers on the theory of numbers, mechanics, and calculus, where he finished what Newton and Leibniz had started. Back in Russia, he wrote yet more papers, approximately one a month, describing the power of the calculus. Euler was a great fan of Newton's, but his drive for rigour revealed Newton's maths to be a little shaky.
Newton was, without doubt, one of the greatest geniuses that ever existed. His profound knowledge and his acute penetration into the most hidden mysteries of nature will be a just object of admiration to the present and to every future age. But the errors of this great man should serve to admonish us of the weakness of the human understanding, which, after having soared to the greatest possible heights, is in danger of plunging into manifest contradiction.
Euler ironed out the manifest contradiction in Newton's calculus. He rebuilt calculus on new, more solid mathematical foundations. To this day, it's a mathematical triumph. Leonard Euler, the mathematician's mathematician. In the words of the great French mathematician Pierre-Simon Laplace,
"Read Euler. Read Euler. He is master in everything."
If, as you may have heard me argue yesterday, Isaac Newton launched modern science by making it more mathematical, Leonard Euler launched modern mathematics by, well, making it more mathematical. And it would be upon the mathematical shoulders of Euler, not Newton, that the mathematicians of the next two centuries would stand. Thanks for listening to this podcast from BBC Radio 4 with me, Marcus de Sotoy. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget you can collect the whole set, all 10 episodes of A Brief History of Mathematics, as well as the terms and conditions, can be found at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.